evening, Debbie G. from Vista.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Larry for inviting me to come and share. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. And thank you, Mo, for dinner tonight and being a part of my sobriety. And Emmy, thank you for your share. I appreciated it. It's so nice to have that with your mom, you know. It's really beautiful. I love what Alcoholics Anonymous can do in our lives. I just got back from Ohio. That's where I grew up, and I went home for Mother's Day, and it's like I've had a lot of trips home in my sobriety, and some of them been really good, and a lot of them haven't. And so this one was really nice, and I was so thankful that God answered my prayer to give my mom heart peace and me, and we had a really nice visit. My mom's not in recovery, and so it's nice to be able to just love her right where she is, the way she loved me when I was right where I was growing up as a nasty teenager. Anyway, living amends take a long time. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my birthday week, too. I'm coming up on June 1st. I'll be able to celebrate 32 years. I'm in awe. There's a guy from my home group that used to always talk whenever he got his cake about, here I am again taking credit for God's handiwork. And it's like, God's been so good to me. And it's like, the years have just gone by so fast. Happy birthday to the two people who took cakes tonight. That's awesome. I hope that I can get my thoughts together about my love of AA tonight. I grew up in Ohio, and I never felt a part of my whole life. I was one of five kids, and I started drinking really early. I would take sips of my mom and dad's beer after dinner, and they'd always have to come over and pry the glass out of my hand. You know, I'm like, I want the little foam mustache, you know. But anyway, I was always wanting, you know, I like that stuff. And my dad, I was his helper on a Saturday morning, and I wasn't sure what we were doing, but we were in the basement, and there was a pool table and TV room, and he was drilling a hole in the side of the refrigerator, and I was handing him tools, and I wasn't sure what was going on, but I soon found out he was putting a tap in for a keg. Love my dad. And I, but that was handy. And so I don't think he was doing that for his children, but it soon became that. But anyway, but it was, you know, I never felt a part of. I know my parents loved me, and, you know, and I had a good life, and there wasn't abuse in my home. There was alcoholism, but I don't blame my alcoholism on my mom, my dad, grandparents, or anybody else. It's like the big book talks about we drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol. And that's what I found out early on, that I loved the effect, and I sought that as often as I could, any way I could. When I got in junior high was when I really started drinking a lot, and I smoked a lot of pot because it was easier to get at that time for my age group. Imagine that. Anyway, I got the nickname Doobie, and so I went through school. I'd go in the morning when in high school, and they lined the halls, and my friends would always say, "Good morning, Doobie. What's up besides you?" And so it was like I was comfortable, and so anyway. And so I just, I smoked a lot of pot, and I'll never have glaucoma for sure. Anyway. Proactive. And so anyway, I drank as often as I could. You know, we would have to find, we could drink 3-2 beer at 18 in Ohio, which is quite handy. And so I drank a lot, and alcohol didn't cause me any problems that I saw. It caused my mom a bit, but didn't cause me any. And it was, what it did was it took away all my anxiety and my fears and my insecurities, and it made me able to converse with my friends and feel a part of, and I didn't feel awkward, and I was so skinny when I was all through school. You know, I was like skinny as a pickle fork, you know what I mean, where you couldn't find clothes to fit, and I just felt awkward and ugly, and I just, alcohol just took that all away. It was my best friend, I hung on to that until I got to this program, long after it turned against me. long after it turned against me. I hung in there. And so anyway, I'm not a quitter. And so I'll go down with the ship. And so I alcohol wasn't causing me as many problems. I got good grades in school, and I left at 18 and moved to California. I had some neighborhood friends, these three brothers, that they were going to move to California after their mom passed away, and I said, as soon as I graduate, I'll be out there. And so a girlfriend and I left after high school and moved out here, and we stopped to visit my mom's dad, who at that time, both my parents grew up in Michigan, but my mom's parents had moved to Tucson, and I loved my grandparents on both sides, but that was the side of the family we didn't visit as much, because they just drank coffee and smoked cigarettes and talked about God. It's like, we didn't stay very long. Anyway, with the other side of the family was German, brewed beer in the basement, had a lot of fun, you know, big parties over there. So when we would go to Michigan, we spent more time with that side of the family. But my grandparents were living in Tucson, and so I stopped to see them, didn't stay long, you know, coffee, God, cigarettes, and then moved on to California. And it wasn't until I had 7 years in this program that I found out my grandpa had gotten sober in Michigan in 1947. And I never knew that. My grandpa died sober, and it's like, I never knew that. That anonymity was big in our family. You know, back then, like, really, nobody talked about that. But anyway, nobody. And so I didn't know that. And so anyway, so I moved on to California, and I got a good job. I sold carpet and did miscellaneous things for a little while, and then I got an engineering job. I was a draftsman at a civil engineering firm, and I always wanted to be an architect. So I got my drafting job, and I started going to school to be a land surveyor. And it took me 10 years, took me into sobriety to finish a two-year degree. It's like, you know, I wanted to pace myself. you know, you take one class a semester and take summers off. It's like, it drags on. But anyway, I was doing those things that I saw my siblings do, and my parents wanted us all to go to college, and I was trying to live the life that I saw my dad have a great work ethic. I saw my mom keep a great home, and my dad and mom, they did nice things for the neighbors, didn't talk about, they were just good people, and yet I was trying to do all those things because I was comparing my insides to other people's outsides. And I couldn't figure out why I felt so uncomfortable and lonely. No matter whether I was around other people or not, I had this gut-wrenching loneliness my whole life. And so when I was working at this engineering firm and I started partying with those people, after a short amount of time, I stopped doing that because I was so terrified they were going to find out what I was really like and how I really drank, because we would go to bars and they would want to talk. Anyway, it was, you know, I would be like wanting to just slam them down, and I would be obsessed with where the waitress was because it was crowded, and I would get two at a time, but then she would be way over there, and I thought, with the way I'm drinking them, she won't get back in time. And they're like wanting to chat it up, and it was stressful. But anyway, it was just easier to drink alone, you know. I found that for me, it was easier to drink at home. Bless you. Easier to drink at home alone. And so my alcoholism didn't progress a lot for quite a few years. I was going to school, drinking every night, working, and I became like a workaholic because it was what little bit of self-esteem I had, I got from my job and pay raises and promotions, and I loved what I did. And so it filled me up a little bit, but then at night I just drank for oblivion. And then I moved into this place, this apartment in Vista, and I met this neighbor gal, and she was a single mom, and we would drink at night when she didn't have her son, and we were like the glum lot drinkers, you know what I mean? Not fun, we were just complaining about our jobs and how unhappy we were, and Susan soon figured out the problem was we didn't have a hobby. And so she said, you know what, this weekend we're going deep sea fishing. And I go, okay. So I'm like, whatever, I'll try it. And so we went to the Oceanside Harbor on a Saturday morning to go on an open charter boat, and we were there at 5:30 in the morning, and people were drinking on the docks at 5:30. I thought, oh, my God, Susan's right. I'm a fisherman. I'm like, who knew? I hadn't even got on the boat, and I figured it out. But anyway, So we went fishing that day, and we just had the best time. And it's like, I was driving down to meet Mo for dinner tonight, and I'm thinking about, I've got a couple of charters this summer, because ever since in sobriety, I've chartered boats for my coworkers, but we go for fish. Susan and I were quickly trolling for other things. But anyway, we had a great time that, you know, they encourage you to throw up over the railing, blame it on the water, it's all good. And so we were just drinking and partying, and we met these guys, and soon, within a week and a half, I had moved one of them in with me, and he was a unemployed contractor IV drug user. Catch of the day. And so I was, like, you might have caught a mackerel, but I got him. But he was, and it's so nice that it's funny now, because at the time it was like a Al-Anon feature story, you know what I mean? Because I was like, I was putting all my focus on him, my depression and low self-esteem and crying every night from loneliness and all that stuff, you know, and I thought it was because I didn't have him. One more time, I had spent so much time comparing my insides to my siblings' outsides, and they were 3,000 miles away in Ohio, and all three of my sisters were getting married and having kids and building big houses out in the country and having this, what I thought was great, perfect lives. And I'm out here living in my little apartment and drinking every night until I blacked out or passed out, whichever one came first, and getting up every morning and throwing up and swearing I'm not going to drink that day. And I would go to work and I would be throwing up, and then I would, by 10 o'clock, I'd be able to eat some cup of noodles and quiet the disturbance. And by that afternoon, I realized as soon as I got off work, I can have some alcohol after all, because I didn't call in sick. And I never called in sick, and so therefore I deserve a couple, but I won't get drunk. I'm just going to have a couple. And I just did that night after night after night after night. And it was like, so my loneliness and thinking that my siblings had this great life, and then when I met Terry on this fishing boat, I thought, that's it. You know, he's a train wreck. This guy needs my help. And so I'm like, going to take him home and fix him. And so I cleaned him up pretty good. And so he started working again, and his family was telling me how wonderful I was for him, and that he's working again and all this stuff. And it was like, and then I'd catch him shooting up in the bathroom and be a screaming maniac. And I started doing some other drugs. And so when I started snorting stuff, all of a sudden, you know, it was the needles that made him less than. He was my own little lower companion. And he wasn't really, I say that because it's like I had to take the focus off of me. No matter what I did and how I was spiraling down, I had to lower the standard and look at him and to make me feel okay. And that's why I didn't want to be drinking with my coworkers anymore. They were pursuing higher degrees and getting married and having kids and doing healthy things. And I'm, you know, snorting stuff and living a really Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde life. I was able to keep my job by the grace of God and having a good work ethic, but I was losing it. And who I was in the daytime and who I was at night was getting so far apart. I was showing up reeking of alcohol in the morning, and the surveyors would say, Deb, you might want to brush your teeth again. You still smell like alcohol. And I didn't know it was coming out my pores, so I'd be like brushing my teeth and shaking and throwing up. And about that time, my older sister called and said that my mom's alcoholism had gotten so bad that they were going to do an intervention in Toledo, and that my dad and my sisters and my brother were going to Toledo once a week for classes, and it was going to be a surprise for mom. And so we were going to, and not to tell her if I was going to come home, because I would stay at my sister's in the country, and it was not to be discussed with my mom. And before I came home, I was to go to one Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'd never even heard of it, and I had already gone to my doctor because I had such bad stomach pains all the time, and I didn't, you know, I threw up every day, but I didn't think it was connected. And so when I went to the doctor, he was like, you know, he checked me, and he goes, so how much do you drink? And I go, thinking it's really none of his business, but I said, a couple. And so he goes, okay. He goes, well, you might when I tried this stuff, and he gave me a prescription for like this Maalox chalky stuff. And he goes, and you might want to take a look at this literature and help yourself. And he left the room, and he had the AA literature rack in there, like he knew I was coming, you know. And so he had that literature rack. And so afterwards, I went up, and I was going to take some because it was like to the woman alcoholic and too young and 20 questions and all this stuff. And I started to take some, and then I thought, oh, my God, I know what he's up to. There's probably 10 each of all these pamphlets, and after I leave, he's going to count them. And if there's 9, then that's the one he knows I think I am, because that's what I took. And so I didn't take any, because I'm sharp. I got up pretty early that day. But anyway, so I actually fired him as my doctor, and then later went back and thanked him. But anyway, I was so offended. And so I had to go to one AA meeting before I went back to do this intervention. So I went to the Oceanside Alano Club, and there was a young guy there, and he was one of Cliff R's sponsees, and I'm friends with him to this day. But they were all sitting around a table. It was a Saturday morning, and they were reading out of the Big Book or 12 and 12. I don't even remember, but the first guy that shared said, "Hi, I'm Fred. I'm an alcoholic." And I'm like, I'm chewing the cheek to keep from laughing. I'm like, "Hi, Fred." Everybody yells, "Hi, Fred," you know. And I'm like, I'm like, "Oh, my God, this is so hokey." It's like, yeah, put my mom in here. And so anyway, I'm like, oh, like Fred doesn't know his name. You know what I mean? So I'm like, oh, yeah, chewing my cheek. Don't make eye contact, Deb. But anyway, so I'm just judging everybody. I'm missing the message. You know, whatever they're reading is like, rah, rah, like Charlie Brown's mom. You know, I'm missing it all. And then afterwards, the secretary came up to me and he said, "You didn't say you were an alcoholic." And I said, "No, I just drink beer only." And then that voice, you know, that one over here, it says, "You liar, you drink anything, get your hands on." And I'm listening to that, and I'm looking at him, and he's smiling, and I'm thinking, oh my God, he likes me. And so if you're new, he was thinking about chapter 3. And so anyway, I was like sick. And so I said, "No, I'm just here to do an intervention for my mom." And he goes, "Oh, okay, why don't you give me a call and let me know how that goes." So he gave me the North County meeting schedule, so I took it, and he wrote his number on the back of it. And when I got back to my apartment, I turned it over, and on the bottom of the meeting schedule, it said, "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." And I thought, what a beautiful prayer. And I cut that out and taped it to my fridge and pitched that thing in the drawer. Anyway, I didn't need the meeting schedule, so I flew home for this intervention, and daily I had to go back and forth to Toledo from my sister's house out in the country, and I had to get caught up in what they had been doing for months. And I went to an Al-Anon speaker meeting and an AA speaker meeting, and I had to watch videos on alcoholism and see a counselor. And at the end of that week, I met the counselor, and she goes, "So what do you think?" And I go, "Oh my God, I'm an alcoholic." And she goes, "You may be, but we're only here for your mom." And I said, "Oh yeah." Okie dokie. I'm like, I didn't want her. She misunderstood that perhaps I wanted to give it up. I just said I was an alcoholic. There was like a Grand Canyon in between those two things. But I was like, oh no, it's my best friend. And so it was a shock to me. It was a real shock. And I had already, you know, gotten picked up for drunk driving and had to pick up trash on the freeway. And I, too, spent a night in jail. But yours sounded like so much more fun. I made a little scene and got my own cell. And cigarettes. Yeah, but I was alone. Anyway, so, but one night in the pokey was enough for me. But I was just a mess back there. And so we did this intervention for my mom, and she agreed to stay for 28 days. And so all my siblings went home with their spouses, and my dad and I went and got her clothes and dropped them off, and we went straight to the Elks Club to drink. And it's like, I couldn't wait to get there. And it's like, you know, back there they drink in a lot of clubs like that, and it was like, we just sat there, and I finally could exhale. You know, it was like I just needed to drink so bad. It was like I felt like such a hypocrite because I wanted her to buck up and become the mom I always wanted, but I didn't give a damn whether I was the daughter she might have wanted. All I cared about was that selfish self-centeredness, and all I wanted to do was get out of there and drink because it was so stressful to tell her how to straighten up. And so we just drank, never talked about what just happened. Not at all. Talked about who I should pick in the football pool next week and how the weather was out here and all that superficial stuff. And I came back to California, and you guys had made a difference in my mom's life when she got out of treatment. That was in the summer sometime. And she was sober and was going to meetings and playing golf again with my dad. And she's a funny lady when she's doing well. And she was super funny and happy. And in November of that year, her dad, my grandpa, who had been sober, passed away. And she had foot surgery. And she stopped going to AA. And she's been drinking ever since. And it's like it just about took her out a few times over these past years. And the thing that was so nice about this Mother's Day and being there was that, you know, when I hit my bottom, I hit a few and bounced, but when I hit one where I called my mom on a Saturday morning and I was like, oh my God, Mom, I can't quit drinking and I don't want to lose my job, because I thought I had to go to a treatment center because that's what she did. And she said, you don't have to, Deb. You can just go to Alcoholics Anonymous and still go to work. And I didn't know that. And I go, okay. And by that afternoon, I realized I'd called a little too early. You know what I mean? I'm like, back in the back in my cups. And so, but, you know, like a couple of days later, I get this big manila envelope, and there it is, all the pamphlets that the doctor had laid out. And my mom sent me all this information on Alcoholics Anonymous, and never once did she ask me, did you read it? Did you go to a meeting? She never once pressured me. And I've been able to give that gift back to my mom all these years and just love her right where she is, because I believe deep in my heart that my mom is loved by God as much as he loves me, whether I'm sober or drunk, whether it's a homeless person or somebody shooting up or whatever. It's the only difference is that when I drink, I cut myself off from the sunlight of the Spirit, but it isn't because it doesn't shine. It's because I severed it. And so it's like, I know God loves my mom as much as he does me. And I just, I'm grateful that I felt like we had a really nice relationship this week. And so I'm thankful for that. So I came back here, and I kept on drinking even after I got all that literature and stuff, because I didn't read it. I just had that in a drawer, too. And so I kept on drinking, got picked up for drunk driving, made that little scene, and then that didn't cause me to stop either. I was drinking a lot of near beer while I was picking up trash on the freeway, because I knew that it was just, I was only drinking for the taste. So it's like, that stuff's nasty. Anyway, I moved into this little guest cottage, and it was up this really steep driveway in Vista, kind of out in the country, and the landlord's house was in the front, and you drive around behind it, and up above the garage was this little tiny dollhouse with slanted ceilings, and it was like 400 or 500 square feet, and I moved in there 2 months to the day from when I got sober, and at the end of my drinking, I was so terrified when I was in that place that people were looking in the windows that I drank with the lights off. You know what I mean? Those tall people. And so I am. So since I knew they were looking, I figured out, because I'm sharp, that if you turn the lights off, they can't see you. And then I realized, well, you're still smoking. Every time you take a drag, then they know where you are. And so I decided I better drink on the kitchen floor. And so which is all right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But my world, when you live alone, there's no argument. But anyway, so I'm drinking down there, but it's really hard to get up, you know. It's like hanging on to the drawer handles, get your butt up. But anyway, and so at the end of my drinking, I was 26 years old, and I'm falling into the walls of this little tiny place to get through the bedroom to get into the little bathroom. They had the slanted ceilings, and I fell sideways into the dry bathtub, and I couldn't hardly figure out how to get out. And I'm lucky I didn't knock my head out. You know what I mean? I was so drunk and obliviated at 26 years old, and so all I was trying to do was throw up, and that was it, so I could drink some more. And that's where alcoholism had taken me. And I had long since stopped doing the drugs when I moved into that place. I had gotten rid of that IV drug user. I had moved him in and out so many times, it was like I had a whole shoebox of deadbolts. I can change a deadbolt out so fast, it's not fun. That ought to be my side business in retirement. But anyway, call it the Resentment Deadbolt Company. I'm sorry. And so every time I'd just go home, if he wouldn't come home at night, you know, and I'd be resentful in the morning, as I should be. And so I would stop on the way home from work, get another deadbolt, change it out, so when he did decide to come home, he couldn't get in, and I'd be drinking on the other side in the dark, of course. And so joyful that he couldn't get in, and then the next day I'd call him, keep coming back. And so do round 13. So after about a year and a half of that, I was tired. But anyway, moved him out for the last time, and it was like, you know what, I realized that didn't fix me either. All of that didn't fix me either, and it didn't matter what he did, whether he was good or bad. It was where I was going internally. I was just spiraling out. And so when I moved him out, I stopped doing the drugs, so it was just my alcoholism. And those years, all it did was, you know, the big book says we don't regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. And it's like those years and doing other things than alcohol just fast-forwarded my alcoholism. And I believe it got me here sooner, so I'm thankful for that. So when I came to on June 1st, 1985, it's like I had a profound spiritual experience, and I still believe in angels because of that. I was at my dining room table, and it was way up on top of that hill, and I was looking out, and I had a great view from up there, and I was just sobbing, and I had come to again, and only that IV drug user was there, and I hadn't been with him for over 2 years, and I was in and out of blackouts that night. I remember calling him up and inviting him over, and then in and out of blackouts, and it was morning, and there he was, and I was fighting with him again about why he missed my birthday 3 years ago, because, you know, can't let it go yet. Anyway, and so I threw him out, and I was crying, and I was like, I saw the connection between all the pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing things I did when I was out there in my alcoholism in me. It was me and alcohol every single time. I couldn't blame it on him, couldn't blame it on my mom, couldn't blame it on anybody. It was me every time, the jail, all the embarrassing things I did, and all the things that went against my moral values. And it's like, and I just said, God, help me. And he did instantly, because it was heartfelt. I just said, God, help me. And somebody picked me up right up out of the chair. And that's why I believe in angels, because I was sitting down, and it was just like getting yanked out like that. And I went over to the kitchen counter, and my mind was completely quiet. And it never was. That's what alcohol did for me for a lot of years that I loved, was it quieted the disturbance. And I went over, and my mind was quiet, and I wasn't afraid at all. Not at all. And I watched my hand. I had no idea what I was doing. It was like I was looking out my little peepholes, and I'm like, what we're doing here? And so I watched my hand open the phone book, and my finger stopped at the Alano Club. And I thought, oh, that's where that AA meeting was. So I just dialed, and this lady answered, and I knew Judy for years after that. She was about this tall, and Judy answered. She goes, hi, I'm Judy. I'm a happy alcoholic. And I'm like, whoa, Judy. You know how your head's like, wow, wow. Like, tone it down, Judy. Anyway, and so she's a bit much. Anyway, and so she said, can you come to a meeting right now? And I said yes, and I just hung up the phone, and I went to the Alano Club. And the thing, it was just like what was read tonight when you were sharing about the beginning sentence that's above the 12 traditions. It says, to those now in its fold, Alcoholics Anonymous has made the difference. To those now in its fold, in the middle. If you're in the middle, AA makes a difference. And that's what Judy did for me from the very first day. She pulled me into the middle. She said, come over right now. And she pulled me into the meeting, even though I wasn't there for the beginning of it. And I'm so thankful that she didn't say, well, let's see, if you leave Vista now, by the time you get here, you're going to interrupt the meeting, so don't come until tonight. She said, come over right now. And I would have talked myself out of it. And so she pulled me into the fold. And so many millions of people literally have kept me into the fold. Sometimes it's been sponsors, it's been sponsees, it's been speakers. I don't even know their names. It's been newcomers that share from their heart. A million different people have kept me in the fold, and they light that little fire that gets dim when I get back into my selfish self-centeredness. So anyway, thank you. And so I started going to meetings, and they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and to get commitments at those meetings, and I did that. And then I just kept going into a meeting every day for well over a year, a couple of years. And I had lots of commitments, and it made me feel a part of. And I wasn't sure that even though I had that spiritual experience, that God wanted to hear from me. And Judy was so neat. She never sponsored me, but she was so great to me. She said, if you don't believe in God, believe my God's big enough for the both of us. And she said what she did every morning was she gets on her knees and asks God to remove the obsession and desire to drink, and gets on her knees every night and thanks God for another day of sobriety. And I still do that every single day to this day because it works. And it's worked for almost 32 years, and I'm not going to stop doing it. I pray to God I don't. And so I prayed, Judy's God, please remove the obsession and desire. And I did that for 3 days. And then I thought, I want to try it on my own. I want to go to my God. And I did that, and it worked. And so I just bagged hers. And so got my own Judy. And it was working, and it's been really good. But Judy was just so neat because she was just on fire for AA. She had the little twinkly eyes, you know. She looked like one of those sandpiper birds, you know, that ran real fast and the legs moved, you know. Anyway, and so she was really neat because after a few months of sobriety, I figured out here, because I was going to a meeting every day, that you guys don't drink ever. I'm like, oh my God. I called her up like in the middle of the night when I realized this. I go, Judy, you don't drink ever. And she goes, yeah. And I go, no, I mean even on your wedding day or Christmas. And she goes, well, are you engaged? And I said, no. She goes, well, won't worry about that. And so, she said, and as far as Christmas, she goes, honey, it's June. She goes, we do this. She goes, in fact, you can even drink tomorrow unless you wake up tomorrow and it's today, because we don't drink today no matter what. And I'm like, okay, I'm trying to track with her, you know. So but when you wake them up, that's what you get. And so I, but she just fed me this stuff, these little nuggets, you know, to learn how to stay sober. And I didn't read the big book when I was new because it was too big. I was like, you know, I was like, had ADD or something. It was just like overwhelming trying to retain what I was reading. So I got the thinnest book on the literature table. It's called Living Sober. And it's an awesome book. And it helped me so much in my sobriety. So if you're new and that big book is too big, just start with the thin one. Anyway, and so I started working my steps. And I did all my steps. And I've done them multiple times. And it's like, you know, I love that we don't have to do it perfect here. And you know, you don't have to drink to start over. I've had different times where I've had, you know, riddled with different fears, 100 different forms it talks about in the big book, but where fear has been the dominating thing in my life, and I've had to do that. I had to do multiple inventories on my boss, who they just eliminated his position. Anyway. It's a birthday present. So anyway, but I should have just Xeroxed all my 10 steps. He was on there again and again and again. And here's my part, my defects. Again, here's what's on parade. You know, the last column, the one that's always the hardest to do. I can take a thorough inventory, especially his, since he wasn't. And so anyway, I multiple times. And then I get to my part and my defects and how I'm slandering and gossiping about him and disrespectful and bad body language and just, you know, all the different things that I would have to ask God through 6 and 7 to remove so that I could be a better employee. And I'm really grateful that for the last couple of years we've been good. And I was able to go in and wish him well and mean it. I wished him well, and then I've been really happy. But anyway, I am. So it's like, you know, doing the resentment prayer in the big book. The story in the back of the book, Freedom from Bondage, has the exact formula for how to get rid of resentments. And it says to pray for people every day for 2 weeks to have everything in life you want for yourself, and it'll set you free. And I love that it says, even if you don't mean it and it's only words, do it anyway. And that was my out, you know, because it worked, you know, it worked. I had to do it forever, but it worked. And so I've been able to be free of resentments by doing that kind of stuff. And I've had, you know, really great times in sobriety. You know, I had this list when I was new of all the things I wanted in sobriety, and it's like I wanted a husband and a bunch of kids, and I wanted to own a home and go to Europe and Alaska and pass the LS and LSIT exams to be a licensed land surveyor and get my degree. And that was my list. And it's like, when you would read the promises, I thought, those are kind of flimsy. You know, we'll know peace, woo-wee, and we'll, and we'll comprehend serenity. And it's like, now I love those. Those are great, you know. But when I was new, I'm like, what about husband? Got anything in there about money? Anyway. And so, but those were really my old ideas. And that's why what that list was of wanting a husband and kids and material things and all that kind of stuff, it was what I came in here with, is thinking that, okay, now that I'm sober and I'm so grateful that I have a God in my life now and I have a primary purpose to stay sober and help other alcoholics, but I really wanted those outside things and then I'd really be happy. And really what changed me was working the steps quickly and slowly, you know, at different times, and being able to make amends to people and clearing away the wreckage of the past and getting a relationship with God and being able to sponsor people, having women like Mo in my life that fill me up and fill a void. I never got married, didn't have the kids, didn't do those other things. I was able to go to Europe a couple of times in sobriety, and I had really great experiences. And it's like, and I went through like 11 years with a rare blood disease in this program, and on and off high doses of steroids and whack to me out of my gourd, and I'm up in the middle of the night like an angry little tweaker, you know, alphabetizing my spices, you know, because that's what you do. And so anyway, you know, when you're not sleeping and you're jacked up. And so it's like, you know, I went through really hard times with that, and it's like I had surgery and it cured me for a while, and went through stress in the workplace with that boss and was threatened and all this stuff, and I grew another spleen. It's like my sponsor is so compassionate. He goes, wow, maybe you could sell those on Craigslist. And so so I had to go through surgery again, and I've been well for several years now again, and I know God's going to keep me well. It's like if he needs me here, he's going to keep me here. And it's his job to keep me here and my job to stay active in this program and give away what I was freely given. And I, you know, I didn't find out about my grandpa until I had 7 years in this program, and there was some stuff on TV during that time about alcoholism being hereditary, and it was big news, you know. And I called my mom, and even though she wasn't in recovery at that time, we could talk about it a little bit. And I go, Mom, nobody else in the family is alcoholic, just you and I. And they say it's her, and she goes, well, grandpa was, and that's how I found out about it. And in 2000, and so I never talked about my grandpa had passed away before I got sober. And I don't know, maybe he was my angel that picked me up that day. I won't know until I get to the fourth dimension. But anyway, I got to speak at the South Bay Roundup. I got to be their opening speaker in 2000. And the man that was, the man that was leading the meeting, Roger Daniels, got sober in Torrance years ago. So he and his wife Annie come home to Torrance from New Mexico every year. And so he's a part of that convention. So he had me, he was sitting next to me, and he introduced me as the speaker that day. And I told my story, and he said afterwards, he goes, you didn't say much about your grandpa, but you said he got sober in Michigan around 1947. And I go, yeah. And he goes, what town? Because my uncle got sober in Michigan around the same time. Maybe they knew each other. And, you know, in your head, you know, yeah, I'm thinking, are you kidding me? The mitten's big. How many? Oh, I bet they knew each other. And so anyway, and so I'm such a skeptic. But I mean, that's what I was thinking. But out of my mouth came, maybe. So he goes, what? I go, what town was your uncle from? He asked me, he goes, what town was your grandpa from? And I said, this little tiny town outside of Jackson, Michigan. It's called Vandercook Lake. And he goes, that's a town my uncle was from. And I go, oh my God, what are the odds of that? And he goes, is your grandma still alive? And I go, well, yeah. And she was at that time. And he goes, call her and find out if she remembers him. And I go, okay, what was your uncle's name? And he said, Roy Drinkwine. Like, isn't that the coolest name? I'm like, I want to. That's a good AA name. I want to be Doobie Drink Beer. So I'm like, so I go home from the conference and I call my grandma, and she had heart surgery, and I go, so sorry about your heart. Hey, wait, grandma. By the way, do you remember a man by the name of Roy Drinkwine? And she goes, well, yeah, Roy and Frida Drinkwine lived one street over on McDevitt. She said, when your grandpa's drinking got so bad that I had to throw him out of the house, she said, Roy Drinkwine was the man who carried the message to your grandpa. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's so cool. Love you. Bye-bye. And I hung up. I call Roger in New Mexico, and he answered, and Annie's on the phone. I said, Roger, we're related. I'm like, we're all three of us were crying, and it was such a cool thing. And we got to go to the international convention together when it was in Toronto, and we got to hear Mel B., who wrote a lot of books on AA, from Toledo, Ohio. He just passed away not long ago, and he worked in a factory with my one grandpa for 25 years and was best friends with Roy Drinkwine. And the three of us got to be together and hear Mel speak. And then next Thursday, on my 32nd AA birthday, I get to fly to New Mexico and speak at the New Mexico State Convention for Roger Daniels. And so I get to be with him and talk about his uncle and my grandpa. And it's like, that isn't what keeps me here, but those kind of God shots let me know I'm in the right place. And that when I think that the little things that trip me up, because it's not the big deals, it's all the little petty crap, you know, people just not driving right, they get out of my way, you know, they got too many items in the 10 item or less line, you know. Shit, that just eats my lunch anyway. And so, you know, because I'm in a hurry and I got 9 things, count them. Anyway, it's like, you know, a little wound tight. But anyway, I, you know, that kind of all that petty crap and all the resentments and all the things my sisters accuse me of and all that petty stuff goes away when I'm with you. And when I remember that my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics, my life gets filled up. Thank you for helping me.